Well, we said we weren't going to record for a while unless something big happened. I would say, Danny, that this qualifies.
Certainly. I mean, Wade leaving Miami, the only team that he's ever played on, to go home to the Chicago Bulls is big. I don't know if it's good, but it's big.
Yeah, it's big enough that I had to even tell you about it before mentioning that we're sponsored today by the Ring Video Doorbell. Find more about that at ring.com/capspace. And of course, the inaugural sponsor of the podcast, SeatGeek. Get a $20 rebate off your first SeatGeek purchase by entering promo code CAPSPACE in the settings tab of the SeatGeek app. So this was, in many ways, I thought, a situation reminiscent of where the Lakers were with Kobe Bryant. Although Wade, at least, was not coming off an Achilles. Kobe, in his last healthy season, had actually been much better than Wade was in his last healthy season. And they're both, I think, 34. Kobe was given a two-year extension at about $25 million per, one that completely torpedoed the Lakers, basically, for 2 years. And he, of course, was nowhere near worth that. And Wade wanted, basically, that exact same contract. And the Heat just ultimately decided not to give it to him. They struck out on Kevin Durant, which Wade did not help with. They had their eyes set towards 2017, and I think it's unclear whether they finally offered a second guaranteed year for $20 million or not, but they were not willing to move Josh McRoberts, who I think they actually felt could help him, and they didn't also want to have to give up an asset to dump him. And then I think also Wade didn't want to have to go through this exact same thing again for maybe, what, the fourth year in a row or so, where he had to decide, basically, they're going to be asking him to take less, and he had to, again, get his due if he was only getting a one-year deal or had a player option. And so I think he finally just tired of it, and he went to the Bulls.
Yeah, I understand it from Miami's perspective. I mean, I like to be sentimental in the sense of, you know, of players playing for the same team. This is why I proposed a while ago for what I called the cornerstone exception, which would be that guys who had a long tenure on a team, only half of their salary counted against the salary cap, just as a way of kind of dealing with this in a little bit of a way. But we don't have that. We don't have that system. And so Miami would have really hamstrung themselves in a way, depending on what kind of contract they even agreed to. I mean, if they made this exact offer to Wade, there would have been, you know, the McRoberts trade would have happened. They would have been a very shallow team unless they absolutely hit the jackpot on minimum salaries. So that means, you know, nailing a couple D-League guys, getting a couple vets. And I understand why they were uncomfortable for that. And I'm not going to knock Wade for being uncomfortable with that situation, too. You know, if a player wants to do what Dirk Nowitzki did, they can. But if a player chooses not to do that and the team doesn't offer the contract, then they can go.
Yeah, it didn't seem to me that this was necessarily about the idea that they weren't going to be good if he stayed there. And I think it was more just about he was sick of always being the second priority. And let's go through that history, shall we? He has never once been the highest paid player on his team. He took a discount. He viewed himself, and Ethan Skolnick wrote a nice piece about this that you can look at if you want more detail, but he viewed himself, not Pat Riley, as the master recruiter that put together the big three. And I think rightfully, he probably deserved a lot more credit for that than Pat Riley did, even though Pat was viewed as this somehow master recruiter. Then in 2014, Wade had 2 years left, basically, at over $20 million per. It was a contract signed under the old CBA, so you could actually have 2 years left after an ETO. He opted out, and he took less, starting at $15 million, hoping that LeBron would come back and that Bosch might take a little bit less as well. As it turned out, Bosch demanded a full max salary. So Wade, again, now he probably gave back about $6, $7 million in that first contract in 2010. Now he's giving back another $5 million. And then the year after that, 2015-16, he has this huge fight. He didn't really have much in the way of other options that could pay him what he wanted last year. And he finally was able to get $20 million a year. And that one, I think, must have been particularly galling for him because, as we talked about even in the mock-off season, like Dan Feldman, I as his agent and Dan as the Heat GM had this great exchange about, hey, you know, there's no opportunity cost here for you guys other than just paying the luxury tax in terms of paying me what I deserve. And finally, he did get $20 million, but that's still less than the max. He's still not really being made whole. He's still kind of down about $10 million. And now, again, reportedly, the first offer this time was 1 year and $10 million, and he felt like he got into great shape. He played a ton of games for the first time in a while, 74 games. He was great in the playoffs. I mean, we'll have a discussion over how good he really is, especially over the course of a regular season. But certainly in his own mind, he felt like both due to past sacrifices and for other things, he was deserving of a max contract. He didn't ask for that, but he wanted 25, especially when and the flirtation with Durant upset him. The fact that Hassan Whiteside was the first priority, that they asked Hassan Whiteside to be flexible to take less so that KD could come back, but not necessarily Wade. And I think finally that was it. He was fed up and he left.
Yeah, I think that's a good chronology of it. Also, Dan Levitard's piece on this was good in terms of the emotional dynamics of this situation. And yeah, I mean, it felt in a way like it had reached its breaking point. And I think that the whole idea of starting with $10 million is a tactical mistake, just unless you have a really good sense of the guy. Like, maybe that would have been possible even with Dirk, but even then, I think you have to start higher and just be like, hey, if we get better guys, that's actually how we negotiated it in this year's mock offseason.
Right.
Was the idea of, you know, I think we started at a higher number, and then it was, okay, well, if we get more, then we'll go lower. But you have to start there because you have to make a player, even when you have that long history, you need to make them feel valued. I mean, that's an important thing, and Wade deserves to feel valued. This isn't even a hollow situation where you're just trying to puff up a guy. He is the most important player in the history of their franchise.
Well, and this is something that Ethan Skolnick as well has talked about, is this is a business, and this whole Heat lifer thing that they seized upon. Udonis Haslem also is another guy who, you know, had theoretically taken less, although he monetarily probably ended up being made whole ultimately. But, you know, he hadn't really been talked to at all since July 1st, according to Skolnick. And if you're going to bring emotion into it, if you're going to bring this whole thing of loyalty into it, now all of a sudden it's not a business anymore. And then all of a sudden when it becomes a business again, now you're going to get some real ruffled feathers and people are going to be upset. One of the cruel ironies of this, though, perhaps, is in the mock-off season, we ended up where they sort of struck a wink-wink deal where Wade took the minimum this year, would have had a minimum cap hold with full bird rights, and then could have just gotten maxed out for a couple of years at like $35 million per at the end of his career after they'd used cap space in 2017. Or even if he had settled for a lot less last year, let's say he had settled for $10 million last year, his cap hold would have been 15, and then they could have just spent up to the cap and then, you know, given him the max for 1 year at $30 million this year and probably kind of made him whole more that way. But there was not the trust between those parties, and the league would like to have it that way too. Like, you shouldn't be able to make these wink-wink agreements beforehand. That's an illegal thing to do, and I think actually probably there are a lot of observers who are glad looking at this with the Heat that, hey, they weren't able to do this wink-wink thing like they did with, some would say, with Beno Udrih, the way they did with other players in the past where it seemed clear that they were skirting the rules. So, you know, they weren't able to do that. We kind of had more faith in Pat Riley than we did, and now it's really starting to become clear, this whole Pat Riley is this master recruiter, he's someone to be feared. Well, he struck out with James, who, of course, is one of Wade's best friends, as detailed in that Pablo Torre piece a couple of months ago. I'm sure James was in his ear. James felt like he wasn't respected enough, and now Wade apparently felt the same way. But the question is Miami, just from a pure basketball sense, did they make the correct decision in just allowing him to leave?
Sadly, yes. I really think they did. And while we don't know exactly where they're going to go from here, I think that they can do really well with that. And of course, a lot of this hinges on Chris Bosh, not only in terms of whether he plays or not, but whether the situation is resolved. Because if it's unresolved either direction, then that becomes a problem. But outside of that, they have a lot of talent. They do owe some draft picks. But I think that they can do something with this to make themselves a better team long term.
As of now, they are probably at around $30 million or so in cap space in 2017. Not really that much in the context of that year. That's maybe one slot. However, if Bosch were forced to medically retire, then that gets up to $55 million. So you're pretty close then to two max slots, and you'd still have Whiteside and Dragic, which, and, you know, Dragic now, we talked about how many times, like, in the clutch, in the last 5 minutes of close games, for example, he had, like, a below 10% usage rate, and Wade's was, like, you know, high 30s, which I felt like was suboptimal for this team. I do think that paying Wade $25 million this year, they probably didn't have much else to spend it on anyway. Maybe you do that, but then going into that second year, now you're going to punt on all this space in 2017. And I think Wade also saw the handwriting on the wall where, all right, it's going to be this exact same thing again next year, right? And still, it's unclear whether they offered him that second year even at the $20 million. But yeah, I think the problem with Kobe and with Wade is that while in one respect he is owed that money by the organization, in another respect, he's not actually good enough on the floor in a basketball sense to merit that.
Yeah, it is a really tough duality, and while Wade really did put it together this year, he's a guy who, when it starts to fade, I think it's going to be a really big problem, especially on the defensive end. But offensively, you know, he does specific things well, but the second it becomes harder for him to penetrate and all that, because it's not like he has a jumper to fall back on or a lot of other stuff. Like, he didn't develop in those same ways like many hoped, including, I think, both of us. So that is a big risk, and that, I think those things, to me, are also what make him such a strange fit with Chicago.
Yeah, we'll get to Chicago in a second, but just to talk about what Wade was last year, in terms of the advanced stats, RPM, I think he was actually in the negative. Part of that is, and he had, I think, a career low true shooting, this is off the top of my head, but of 51%, had to rely on the mid-ranger more, didn't get to the basket as much or get fouled as much. He still played a lot, which, I mean, he had as good of a season as you could have possibly hoped, but he still took a ton of shots, probably too many compared to guys like Bosch when he was playing, and certainly compared to Dragic. And then he didn't shoot threes at all. He did have that unbelievable playoffs, but, you know, he was hitting a bunch of threes when he hadn't since basically, you know, like December 21st or something like that. He hadn't hit a three, and then he starts going crazy. He hit some really tough mid-rangers. Obviously, he won them that series against Charlotte, but not in a way that I felt was particularly sustainable. And he is certainly not above average on defense. There are times in the playoffs where he could really bring it like he used to, kind of being all over the floor, but just not someone who has the energy like that on a game-to-game basis in the regular season, and maybe not even necessarily in the playoffs. So I think that Wade was very overrated just because he shot a ton and just had pretty good counting stats. And I think if they still had Deng and Joe Johnson, I would feel it was a lock that they would be still pretty good this year. Having lost those guys, they're very reliant on some of the young guys to come in. I think they can be very, very good defensively, but we'll see what happens with this team. We'll get to the Bulls in a second. I mean, that's like, we haven't even gotten to the crazy part of this yet. But first, I want to tell you about the Ring Video Doorbell. I'm actually recording this from a Las Vegas hotel room, and my girlfriend is at home, or sometimes she even spends the night at her parents' place, so there's nobody home, and I still feel secure because we have the Ring Video Doorbell set up there. There's a home burglary every 13 seconds, and a lot of those happen in broad daylight where the burglar actually rings the doorbell to make sure that you're away before breaking in. And the Ring Video Doorbell has been proven to stop burglaries before they happen, allowing you to see and speak to anyone approaching your door using your smartphone. So Ring has now expanded that as well to use advanced motion detection technology to protect your entire property with the Ring of Security Kit. That includes the video doorbell, also a stick-up cam at another location of your choice, which is a wireless weatherproof HD camera, and so you can keep an eye on other parts of your property. It's much easier to install. You can do it in minutes than traditional home security systems, and they provide 24/7 monitoring of your entire home, whether you're there or if you're thousands of miles away, like I happen to be right now. Of course, it wouldn't be a Dunked On ad if my listeners did not get a discount. $50 off the Ring of Security Kit via ring.com/capspace URL. You know Capspace. We talk about it all the time on the program, and you can join the hundreds of thousands who protect their home with Ring by going to that URL, ring.com/capspace for $50 off. That's ring.com/capspace. Also lets them know that you came from us. Well, I tweeted this out shortly after this signing was reported. I still believe, and part of this is based on that, what I think is more likely than not, that Bosch will come back. But even if, you know, even pricing that in, that he may not, I think Miami's going to be better than Chicago next year, even so.
Chicago's roster makes no sense.
Yeah, totally ad hoc. I mean, and which is what it was. They never thought this Wade thing was going to happen. And I think, but if you look at, I can't think of three talented players, and I do think Rondo is still talented, despite the fact that I don't think he was particularly effective last year. I mean, and then Wade and Jimmy Butler, I can't think of three guys who are talented that fit together worse as a perimeter trio on the league than those three guys.
Jimmy Butler had shown some signs last year with the ball in his hands, and the ball is not going to be in his hands a whole heck of a lot now.
Yeah, Butler is very, very efficient. Rondo is incredibly inefficient. And if he doesn't have the ball, now you can just double off him. I made the joke when we talked about it on yesterday's program that it would give us a chance to find out what the young players on Chicago are good at. I said, what is that? Beating a double team? Well, now that's a triple team because Wade can't shoot either. And so Butler's efficiency, he also is not a guy who really moves the ball. He kind of holds it. Same thing with Wade. Rondo, not really a ball mover either. And so it's just really hard to imagine how these pieces are all going to fit. And then you still have Robin Lopez as well, who presumably is going to be starting. He doesn't have any shooting range either. I assume they're going to start Mirotić at the four just because they're desperate for somebody. But, you know, you basically, any action involving him, you can just switch it. And then if you try to go one-on-one, you can just help off of the three guys on the floor who can't shoot. I think that I would be hard-pressed to think of a team offensively that will, at least on paper, would seem to be less than the sum of its parts than this Chicago Bulls team.
But at least they're going to make up for being so good on defense.
Yeah, I mean, Rondo and Wade used to be great players, and you know the jokes have been flying around, justifiably so, of you know which team would be more likely to win the 2011 championship, the Bulls or the Knicks. But it's really, I think, you know, Wade, not exactly an effort guy. Rondo, not exactly an effort guy. Hoiberg, not exactly a coach that has a great track record of getting great defense. Butler is a guy who will defend, and maybe the defense could be a little better just because Rondo and Wade will be dominating the ball and probably upsetting him so much that he'll have more energy for defense. I think he slipped a little bit on that end last year because he was kind of the main guy. And then you've got Mirotić, who's like okay in a team system, but not any good one-on-one. Lopez can protect the rim and defensive rebound, but he's statuesque in the pick and roll. And then, you know, Taj Gibson has fallen off as well. McDermott, who they're going to have to play because they're just going to so desperately need to have some shooting. I mean, I think if you just didn't play Rondo and you just kind of played Wade at point guard and Butler, Mirotić, McDermott, and then, you know, maybe worked in Gibson, you might be able to put together some decent units, but Rondo is not going to be okay with not playing. It's just, I think it is so destined to end poorly. Wade signed a 2 for $47.5 with a second year player option. I don't think that this is going to end too well, and I could see him very easily leaving. I could see Rondo very easily leaving, but probably what the Bulls are thinking is, hey, we got Dwayne Wade to come here. This helps us be more of a free agent destination. Maybe he can help recruit some guys to come here in 2017 when we'll still have about $30 million in space, even if he sticks around. Although we could, again, if he opts out, we could end up with kind of the same thing in Chicago as in Miami, where that he's going to want to get paid a ton by them and not be worth it, and then they'll have a showdown just like they have in Miami the next couple of years. So I understand it from Chicago's standpoint. If they just hadn't signed Rondo, which you could say, oh, they didn't know Wade would be available. Well, we knew that the Rondo move was a terrible move anyway. If they had signed Langston Galloway, who signed for nothing, or re-signed Etuan Moore, or just some point guard who could shoot the ball a little bit. I mean, that's what they need, is someone off the ball who can just shoot it and let Wade and Butler go to work. And then if you had Mirotić, and then, you know, you might be able to do something if you had some shooting out of the point guard position. And now their option, if Rondo isn't providing enough shooting at point guard, is to bring in Jerry and Grant. I mean, has there ever been a worse shooting point guard tandem in NBA history?
And it's also worse in another way for Grant, because he was a possibility in terms of that, but now the players that you're going to be putting him with provide really bad spacing, so that makes it harder to evaluate him as a pick-and-roll maestro moving forward. And depending on how they – I assume that they're going to try to stagger at least Rondo and Wade a little bit, because having them both on the floor, I feel like that's a bad marriage for each of them. And if they're going to do that, then that means Jerry and Grant's probably going to play a lot with Wade. Wade, of course, is going to dominate the ball in those circumstances. Jerry and Grant does not provide much value off-ball to me. And – the other big problem for the Bulls is that we like to think of, you know, people talk about a lot about two-way wings, and there's a legitimacy for that because, you know, you want to have a guy who can at least be a small plus on both ends. Chicago doesn't have a lot of two-way players other than Jimmy at any place. You know, like they don't have a lot of guys who are just going to who you can put on the floor with whoever, and it's really going to work. And so figuring out their combinations of players is going to be brutally hard because you're making some very real sacrifices, and there aren't those clear-cut guys of like, oh, well, we can trade him because he's valuable and get something else that fits better.
Yeah, again, this is another one where if they had a better defensive center than Robin Lopez, maybe you could start to think that they could put some really good defensive units out there. It's going to be interesting. I'll give it that. There will be a lot of personalities here, and the irony is that Rondo and Butler were recruiting Wade. I mean, it's funny, like, they don't even seem to realize, like, how bad of a fit he's actually going to be. It's Dwayne Wade. It's the halo effect. And just the fact that Wade played so well in the playoffs, I think, in an unsustainable way, has everyone just completely overrating him right now. And so, I'll have to really think about where these guys are going to fall in the hierarchy. But I don't think that adding Wade as opposed to just, like, some generic two guard who can just make a three every once in a while, like, actually makes them worse just because there's only one ball. You know, people are like, oh, the Warriors is only one ball. Well, those three guys, Clay and Steph and Durant, they can all shoot it, and so they're not taking anything off the table for the other guys, whereas these guys all, like, I mean, Butler's okay spotting up, but he's not, like, a volume guy, and he's the best of the ball in his hands than any of these guys. I mean, I think probably their strategy will be, well, you know, a lot of ISOs, a lot of post-ups for whoever is, you know, probably for Wade or Butler, whoever has, like, the weaker wing defender on them, but it's going to be so easy to get help there that I don't think that even that strategy is going to prove particularly effective.
But yeah, you can rotate around, and something I thought of with this is that I think this Bulls team, as they are presently constituted, is going to lose a lot of really surprising games because they will have nights where they just can't hit anything and they're not consistent enough defensively. Like, I could see them just blowing games to bottom five.
Oh, God, they're going to be so bad in transition defense with, like, Rondo and Wade, like, two of the all-time worst, like, complain about a call and lollygag back. You know, and Hoiberg is not exactly the guy to crack the whip on these dudes. And then Robin Lopez is pretty glacial in transition getting back as well. I mean, they are just going to get fast-breaked to death, I think.
And their offense isn't efficient enough where the other team is going to be dragging the ball out of the basket each time, and that's going to slow down their offense. If I were facing Miami, I would even consider running on makes with some frequency just to try to make some mistakes and wear those guys out.
Yeah, I mean, maybe what you might do is you could play McDermott more at the three, play Butler at the four, and then hope to have, like, Taj Gibson or maybe Felicio. Felicio has a little bit of a three-point shot. Maybe, like, you hope that he can get better from three, that maybe Bobby Portis can give you something from three. They might also look at kind of a shooting center. I think actually Mo Spates would be a good fit here. Not that he can stop anybody either, but just offensively. And so if you had then, you know, like, a center and a power forward, Mirotić, who could shoot threes, and you could kind of invert the offense, then maybe you might be able to get somewhere. Or if they just decide to, like, not play Rondo as much. But I feel like that's something that they are just not going to have the courage to do.
And Rondo is a hard guy. I mean, I saw some people just on Twitter, not in my mentions because I get into Bull stuff that often, but they were talking about, oh, well, he's played for championship coaches. And it's like, yeah, the last championship coach he played for healthy scratched him in the playoffs. So I'm not sure that you can use that as necessarily an arrow in the quiver, in the pro Rondo quiver.
So the other thing that happened, of course, is they needed to clear space to fit Wade in. So they moved on from Mike Dunleavy. He and his $4.8 million salary traded to Cleveland, who actually went after him pretty hard last year, but only had the mini mid-level to offer at that point, which was 3.3. Now they just took him into the Anderson Varejao trade exception. There's now about $4.8 million of that left. And it's unclear exactly what the compensation was. They also then traded Jose Calderon to the Lakers with two second-rounders. We don't know whether those are real second-rounders. We don't know whether Cleveland gave up anything to get Dunleavy or not, or whether there's a pass-through. You know, all three of the teams have to touch one another is the terminology in some way. So if you did a three-way trade, they would each have to get something from one another. So we'll have to see. I mean, but it sounds like getting off of those, that money wasn't any worse than two second-round picks at worst for the Bulls, and we'll see what ends up happening there. But what do you think of the Dunleavy acquisition for Cleveland?
I'm of two minds on it. One is that if he's healthy, I think Dunleavy adds something that is very useful for Cleveland. I think he is pretty reliable in terms of shooting. His other stuff is a little bit shakier, especially now after his injuries. But my big conceptual issue with this is not related to Dunleavy, but related to the Dellavedova decision. And so they made the choice to not match on Delly. And part of it was presumably because that was, again, the opportunity cost was Dan Gilbert's dollars. It was not anything in terms of anything else. Cleveland has their money. Assuming LeBron re-signs, they're basically capped out until, I believe, 2019. So you can understand the idea of, oh, he's not worth that. Matthew Dellavedova made a pretty substantial difference for them in the regular season, even if he wasn't that valuable in the playoffs. And Dunleavy will not provide that, especially because their point guard situation is Kyrie Irving, who has an injury history, and you don't want to push too hard in the regular season, Mo Williams and Kay Felder.
Yeah, and they're pretty much down to the minimums now. They also brought back Richard Jefferson, 2 years, $5 million. That looks like it is basically about as much of their mini mid-level that they could use, which is 3.5 this year, and still have room left for Felder. The reason that they needed to leave some for Felder is because if you use the minimum exception, then you can only sign him to 2 years. So they probably wanted to get him in for three, so they left a little bit of space there to sign him. But yeah, Mo Williams as the backup point guard, when he missed half the year last year with kind of nebulous knee soreness and is now a year older, maybe they can get some sort of ring chaser. Maybe they feel like they could trade for someone or get someone in the buyout market. But I do feel somewhat uncomfortable there. And then, you know, is LeBron going to just play point guard more when Kyrie is out? That seems like a big burden on him. A couple of reasons that I worry a little bit about Dunleavy. Obviously, LeBron likes him. He recruited him personally, and this might have been something that LeBron was pushing for. Dunleavy did not look good last year. He missed half the year with back surgery. He's, I think, 36 now. And to me, it's very clear that nobody in the East is going to challenge Cleveland still. So if that's the case, every single move you make should be about competing with this enormous Warriors monolith that just got created. And to me, Dunleavy just doesn't play with enough force. He's too slow. He's too old. Not a good enough defensive player to where he's going to help you much against Golden State, frankly. So I think that while I guess it helps to have him and just having some more wing guys, now you can play LeBron at the four a little bit more. That's nice for the regular season. Might even be nice for the East playoffs. And that's if Dunleavy is the guy that he was 2 years ago, which when a guy has back surgery at 35, he damn well better start playing well again before I believe that he's back. And I don't think he really did that last year. So maybe you could say, well, this is the best they could have done with that TPE, but I probably would have just kept it in reserve and seen maybe what I could have gotten around the trade deadline with, you know, they do have some assets. They've got Chetty Osmond still. They've got some first rounders way in the future that they could move. So I would have stuck around and seen what I could have gotten, because the guys that you can get with $4.8 million is a lot less than $9.6 million, is what the trade exception originally was.
And remember that they gave up a first-round pick to create this trade exception, and they did unload Anderson Varejão, and I could make a convoluted argument that doing that helped them win a championship.
It really did.
It totally did.
Maybe it is quite possible that they won the championship by trading him away and then having him sign with the Warriors. Oh, man.
I'm really happy I hadn't posed that idea.
But then you could also make a convoluted argument that now they have much less shot of winning again because now Kevin Durant's in Golden State, which you wouldn't have been. All right, it's too late at night for these sort of what-ifs.
But what I want to get to is, so I had been fiddling, as I want to do, with the Warriors trade exception situation before Kevin Durant signed. And there is a really narrow market for guys. Like, I'd even toyed with Vince Carter as being a possibility for either the Cavs or the Warriors.
That trade exception is now gone, by the way, because they used
Cavs. Correct.
Go ahead.
And so I had appreciated how that was limited, but what I thought about was one of the most intriguing uses of a trade exception in the modern market is actually for claiming guys off waivers. And so there could be this middle ground of somebody who just doesn't really fit with another team. And if you put in a waiver claim using a trade exception that is big enough to and take their in the whole salary, that works. And I don't know that it would have necessarily led to somebody, but at least it's an intriguing possibility.
Yeah, and it could well be the case that this is the best that they could have done, but I probably would have just chilled out on that and waited. But he's a guy that LeBron likes. I highly doubt that LeBron was scouting his games last year to see that he wasn't really recovered from back surgery. So I don't know. We'll see what ends up happening. But I don't think that Cleveland has basically done all that they can do now other than just getting some minimum guys. So it's going to be...
They need a backup
center.
The
idea that they're... What'd you say?
They need another center. Are they going to play Sasha Khan? I mean, of course they can...
Yeah, that's true. I guess Tristan Thompson... Oh, no, they got Fry.
Yeah, but right. I mean, don't you want a defensive, like, another... in case... I mean, Tristan Thompson has been an absolute Iron Man, but... Don't you want to have somebody just...
I think they're fine with two traditional centers. They got Kevin Love, too. Like, that three-man front court rotation, they're going to play Love at center or some too. They'll be fine with that. I think their biggest issue is they need another athletic wing type of guy.
Well, I agree with you. It's not their biggest need. And they can hopefully get somebody for the minimum, but they will need somebody for the minimum.
And hopefully they can get some more out of Amon Shumpert this year, too, who was injured for basically the first half of last year. I think with him having some time to work on his game, maybe he can get back to being kind of as good as he was 2 years ago. We should talk still about Miami, too, because they've got a bunch of other stuff going on of where they go from here. But first, if you want to go and see this Chicago Bulls potential train wreck or star-studded team, depending on your view of things, the best way to do so is going to be SeatGeek. SeatGeek's the inaugural sponsor of the Dunktown Basketball Podcast, the first place I always go to look for tickets to a game or concert, and everything about it is designed to make life easier for sports or music fans. SeatGeek does all the price comparison for you. It aggregates together a bunch of sites. Now you're not like, oh, I got to go to a ninth site because I looked at eight, and oh, what if there's a better deal out there? No worries about that anymore. You're getting all the deals at your fingertips in one place. Every SeatGeek ticket is given a grade based on value as well, so you can see any seats that are good deals. Or if you're trying to sell tickets as well, you have a good idea of kind of where you should price them to get a fair price, but not have them sit out there for too long if you're overpricing them. And of course, it wouldn't be a Dunked On ad if my listeners didn't get a rebate. In this case, $20 off of your first SeatGeek purchase using the CapSpace code. You download that free SeatGeek app, go into the settings tab, click on add a promo code, enter promo code CapSpace. We talk about it all the time here on the program. And SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. So download the free SeatGeek app and enter promo code CapSpace today. So Miami, the first news that we've got for them is that despite the fact that they had opened some dialogue with Tyler Johnson about not actually signing that offer sheet with the Nets, they were unable to reach an agreement, and he has now, in fact, signed that offer sheet. 4 years, $50 million. The structure on that is going to be the mid-level exception amount, $5.6 million in the first year, then a 4.5% raise the second year, and then the next 2 years, basically, so that's about $12 million out of your $50, and then the next 2 years are split, essentially, the remaining $38 million of that. So it's if the Heat match it on their books, it's really small for the first couple of years, which could be useful for them if they want to use 2017 space, but then it could get ugly in the last couple of years when he's making like $18 and $19 million or so. And then, of course, because it's an Arenas offer, he has 2 years of experience, he's a restricted free agent. The Nets books, it's basically going to be $12.5 million every year. The cap hit is averaged out. If you're Miami, I mean, it seems like they would prefer that it not be the arena structure, but what would you have preferred?
I think I would have not preferred the arena structure just because this is different than the Lakers, where it looked like they had a pretty clear timeline for the Lakers that it was like, okay, then spend in 16, you can spend in 17, and then if you haven't spent by then, you're kind of screwed. With Miami, it might take them a year or two to kind of sort all this stuff out. And so I think it would have been better, presumably, unless you're really optimistic about what they can do with their cap space this year, to go in that kind of a direction. So I understand why they wanted to do it from that perspective. And I mean, I was Miami in the mock off season, and deciding on Tyler Johnson was something incredibly hard. Oh, one small thing, because people get confused on this all the time, that I want to mention is that, so the structure that Nate mentioned in terms of five, mid-level and then jump, that is his actual salary. So whether the cap gets balanced out, whether he's on the books, that is how he is actually paid.
Yeah, and that was one of the things when Lynn signed one of these offer sheets that made him a little bit less palatable for him to trade in the last year of that deal, even though his cap hit was lower with Houston. So Miami now with $18.8 million or so left to spend, and that includes Johnson's small cap hold, which is another reason you want to match because you can get extra spending power this year. It appears, however, with the slim pickings remaining on the market, that there's no one really worth jumping on to punt on 2017 space, really, that's left. I mean, is there anyone left on the market that you're like, hey, I really would like to sign this guy to a market value deal with money stretching in 2017?
I mean, the best players on the board are generally centers, and they don't really need those guys. And the restricted perimeter players, Crabbe, Harkless, Deion Waiters, I don't particularly like their fits, especially considering how much money is out there. You know those guys are going to get paid.
Yeah, I think that's right. And Crabbe would be a decent fit because with Winslow, with Josh Richardson, because he can shoot the ball and they really need someone who can shoot it. But yeah, that is a pretty rough price. Do you really want to pay Crabbe $18 million a year and punt on getting a max free agent in 2017? Assuming Bosch comes back, probably you don't want to do that. And then as for bigs, they got Bosch and they got Whiteside already, so none of those restricted bigs really appeal. So I think you're going into the discount bin if you're them. Maybe you could make the argument that Mo Harkless might fall into that category, especially if something happens with Portland where those guys all get big offer sheets and maybe they feel like Harkless is the one who's more expendable, because keep in mind they've already got Aminu, and who they view as a starter. He's on a great contract. And then they have Evan Turner, who they're paying like a starter, to be their three and their four, probably. And they're going to need shooting, so you think probably Crabbe is more important in Portland's plans than Harkless. So maybe you could get Harkless at something that wouldn't be too bad, you know, like $12 million a year or something. Maybe that's something I might consider signing him to, because they could definitely use a sort of combo forward of the future. I don't know that Winslow is quite big enough to where you really want him, and then you're just going to have to teach those guys to shoot, obviously. But other guys just in the short term I think could be good. Maybe Troy Daniels on a restricted offer sheet. Charlotte still has his rights, but they don't, and they do have full bird rights on him, so they could match it. But you have to imagine that with Bellinelli and with Lamb already there, they're not really looking to pay much for Troy Daniels. I think Wayne Ellington is someone who could be a decent fit, get you a little bit of shooting off the bench, maybe a Marcus Thornton type as well. I mean, they're going to need guys who can create offense.
I like Lance Stevenson there.
Yeah, I do too, although I think, remember that Whiteside just got paid and that you might be starting to get into a little bit too much of the knucklehead factor. I agree.
I would do him on a one-year deal. I would not give him more than one.
Yeah. Yes, he's one. I mean, it's certainly someone that I thought of. Alan Anderson as well, someone, you know, that you might want to pay. Grievous Vasquez, again, someone, you've got some other defenders you could put around him. Mario Chalmers, maybe kind of have him playing more at the two a little bit, playing alongside someone like Richardson or Tyler Johnson. I think that could be okay. And then maybe for bigs, like a Terrence Jones type, see what you can do to kind of rehabilitate
some
of these guys.
Markel,
yeah,
got,
I think
he was unrestricted now, so.
Yeah, he's pretty redundant to me with Winslow, and I mean, he probably won't cost you much, obviously, but I think with Winslow and Richardson, he's kind of redundant with those guys. I want guys who can shoot it. I mean, I need someone who can attack off the dribble or shoot it. Those are their two biggest needs. And, you know, there's some fringe guys around, too. Oh, the other thing that they actually could consider, too, is just make J.R. Smith like a one-year $19 million offer. He actually would be great there, and at least at the very least, you force Cleveland to like kind of pay more than they want to for him. And Randy Foy, another guy who just, you know, maybe could give him 10 or 15 minutes of decent shooting off the bench. Isaiah Kanan might be another guy too, just who can shoot it a little bit. They have other perimeter defenders who can prop him up. So they have some options, I think, who could help them. And because they have such good defenders, that sort of these offensive players who are flawed in other ways as just either shooters or penetrators or just shot creators might work right. Okay, but I think, especially if Bosch comes back, I think they could be still pretty decent and athletic and try to run more and all that stuff.
I'm excited about Dragic. I mean, Dragic is a guy that I've liked for a long time, and I think that now they have talent which is more conducive to what he does well.
Yeah, he's going to be 30 now, so we'll see what he can still do. But yeah, I do think that he was in a lot of ways underutilized. I mean, he has a track record of being more efficient of late than Wade, and he also actually can shoot the ball a little bit too, which they're going to kind of need. So, but at his age, you probably don't want him playing more than maybe 34 minutes a game, and they're going to need someone else who can create some offense for them other than him. Let's get to L.A., Avika Zubac, the 32nd pick, big, huge Croatian center. He is coming over, three-year deal, 2 years guaranteed, probably pretty near the minimum, maybe not quite there. And then they got Calderon and those 2 second rounders. Calderon, I guess they kind of needed a third point guard, and, you know, it's not like they were doing anything else with that space, and I'm glad that they're at least realistic about that, picking him up in the last year of his contract, basically, you know, $7.7 million of relatively dead salary. That probably also means that Marcelo Huertas, if they're not going to revoke his qualifying offer, at least he's going to kind of be out there. He's actually someone else I think could be pretty decent as a backup in Miami, again, because he can create off the pick and roll, and they'll have other guys around him athletically who can cover for the fact that he is, you know, not really an NBA quality of athlete. Not much else to say on the Lakers here, though. They are now down to about $12 million or so in space, and I would recommend still that they kind of just keep that open, see what scenarios pop up, try to pick up some more assets, and maybe even that could facilitate a potential Westbrook trade at some point during the year, although that seems like an unlikely dream.
Houston made, I honestly think it might be one of the most surprising signings of the offseason.
How did he get so little?
So Nene signed for the room exception for 1 year, and it is completely dumbfounding, not only because it, so, like, when you see, if you saw that Nene signed for 1 year for the room exception, I speculated that he was a guy that the Warriors could look at for the room exception. You could go, okay, so maybe he did that on a championship contender where he could be, like, a rotation player. That is not what Houston is. Like, Houston is not that team. And also, while it's a great value contract, and I'm not going to knock it anyway for that, Demo, his best value was playing some at center, and now they have two centers that are probably higher than him in the pecking order. So even though it's a good contract, and I support them signing him to it, it does create this weird logjam that you wouldn't expect on a team that is as kind of as open as the Rockets are.
Yeah, when you consider this deal, first of all, why wouldn't Washington have just offered him more, number one, instead of paying Jason Smith?
Oh, God.
Nene is so much better than Jason Smith, and it's fine if he gets injured a little bit. I mean, I guess Washington doesn't really want to play with two non-shooting bigs anymore, and maybe he just kind of wanted to move on from there and wanted a fresh start. And Nene has made plenty of money in his career, certainly. I mean, he's made over $100 million. The Pacers, I would have liked him a lot better than Al Jefferson, that's for sure. I think if it was really going to be for that little...
The Clippers? I mean...
Yeah, that would have been one, too. I mean, I think he...
Given the biannual exception.
Yeah, I mean, maybe Nene thinks just that he might actually be able to start in Houston. You know, maybe that's what the appeal is there, that he'll just be able to start for this team. But yeah, I mean, I probably would have offered him a little bit more if I were Miami too, although, you know, the whole Wade thing hadn't worked itself out at that point either.
You need to give me more warning if you're going to start to intimate that Clint Capella is not going to start. My heart needs more prep than that.
Yeah, and the Blazers actually would have been one that I think really should have given him a look. They actually met with Festus Ezeli today, but Ezeli went home without a contract. I do think Ezeli would also be an excellent fit there. He falls into the category of you could sign him. He has some upside to be a defensive center for them, but also they're not relying on him because they still have Plumlee and Davis and maybe even Myers Leonard as well.
Can I make a small note that I found it very amusing that...
Oh, you know who else could have got in on him was the Raptors. Sorry,
yes.
I will now... please continue with your small note.
So I was amused that there were some people that were very excited about the idea that Festus Ezeli had a one-way ticket to Portland, but even though, you know, he had other meetings that he was discussing. It's like, Festus Ezeli has the money to sign to pick a one-way destination to somewhere else. Like, this is not an issue, like, oh, he's committing to them. I mean, it was a preliminary meeting. He became an unrestricted free agent, like, yesterday. Actually, 2 days ago, but whatever.
New Orleans, with an absolute steal again, really have loved what they have done this offseason. Langston Galloway, he signed for, it was unclear what the reporting was, Mark Berman of the Post, or BOTP, as Frank Isola so affectionately calls him, reported that he was getting between $5 and $6 million a year, which makes sense, and he has a second-year player option on that two-year deal. That makes sense because the Pelicans had about $5.7 million in space left, assuming that they waived Luke Babbitt and Tony Douglas. So that still is an excellent deal. The Knicks, of course, even when they had renounced his qualifying offer or withdrawn his qualifying offer, still could have offered him early bird, as we discussed yesterday, with his off of his minimum cap hold. But Berman reporting that they have an eye on saving cap space for 2017, and they believe that Justin Holiday can be their backup shooting guard, and that the Knicks had only offered him $3 million a year. That is crazy to me. I think, yeah, they are at about $30 million in 2017 space, and I think although Rose will be a free agent, that's about what the max is. So theoretically, maybe if they have some awesome year, they could bring in a max quality guy. But if they have some awesome year, it's going to be because Derrick Rose actually plays pretty well, so they'll be pressured to re-sign him. But nonetheless, it's not like they couldn't have traded Galloway. Anyway, I think this is really just a bad use of resources by the Knicks letting him go. Apparently, they just did not value him as a combo guard who could shoot the three. I mean, to me, he was like pretty much close to the level of Tyler Johnson. Johnson maybe a little bit more athletic. But, you know, I think that's a great deal for New Orleans. And then if he opts out, he actually, because he'll be in his third year, he'll still be restricted as well. So they would still be able to match any offer on him. And I think that's great. Like, just they've got him. It's funny. Again, this is another one of these signings where it's like these teams see value and it's redundant. They already signed Etuan Moore, who you would look at as a very similar player, a little bit more dynamic off the dribble. But they now just have a lot of guys who are young, who don't have injury histories, and who can play some defense and can play multiple positions. And I really like having that around Anthony Davis. They have now Galloway. They have more. They may still be able to bring back Tim Frazier, although actually, no, they probably will not unless he just takes the qualifying offer. Yeah. They used they could maybe sign him to the room exception. They still have that left.
Yeah, and so a point that I heard today, and I would give credit, though I don't remember who it was, I just saw Mason Ginsburg of Bourbon Street Shots retweeted it, was the point that this is the New Orleans offseason that they should have had when they drafted Anthony Davis like a few years ago. You get guys who are young and who are athletic and who can hit open shots instead of doing all of the other kind of mistakes that they made over these years. And a lot of these guys, not only will they provide surplus value, but you can get a better baseline in terms of talent, because last year they just were ravaged by injuries, because part of it was they had really bad injury luck, but part of it was that they didn't build a roster full of NBA players.
Yeah, it seems crazy to say it, but this is actually like kind of a deep team now. They're pretty weak at center, but I think that,
oh God.
But I think that they can just not play those guys, you know, and AD, especially if you're going against kind of smaller teams, they have enough defense around him too that I think they'll be in better shape now, that they'll be able to pressure up on the perimeter. They've still got Evans. I mean, a lot of this is going to rely on Evans coming back to give them like a second penetrator as well, but you can almost sort of split some minutes between Holiday, who probably should still be on a little bit of a minutes limit as well, and Evans at the point, and then you've kind of got these guys around them who can defend, who are versatile, who can switch on defense and prevent penetration. I like this team as just an athletic team that's going to play hard. They still, and then Buddy Hield at least hopefully can provide somewhat of a modicum of shooting. They have a lot of guys who are kind of, you know, question marks in terms of shooting, with Hill, Galloway, Moore. Those are all guys who have shot it okay at times, but also are not necessarily established guys from beyond the arc. But also AD is an excellent shooter, and Holiday's pretty good for his position as a point guard, and presumably Hield is going to play a lot. So I think their positional shooting will be okay. But yeah, I mean, I think we'll have to kind of think more about where New Orleans is going to shake out. But I think they're really out of the consciousness right now. And if Evans can come back and be healthy and Holiday could stay healthy, I think they actually might surprise people a little bit.
And also the overall cost of
the guys, and AD is to be healthy too. He's coming off the surgery too. Let's not forget that.
All of the guys that they got, so their combined salaries aren't that much more than Ryan Anderson got in Houston. Granted, New Orleans wasn't going to give him that offer anyway, but in terms of thinking about how much this costs them, you know, it's with the rising cap, these guys aren't sure things, of course, but if one or two of them work out well, they're all on reasonable contracts. They're not hamstringing you at all, and I really like what they've done.
Yeah, this should be a pretty good defense if they can coach them up now. Let's do some more quick hitters. We mentioned Washington. They signed Jason Smith to a rather inexplicable 3-year, $16 million deal. Of course, since Smith had so much leverage, they were forced to grant him a player option. In the third year, Smith had one of the best years of his career last year. Actually, was great by the on-off metrics, but part of that was just because the Magic had so little shooting. But even in what was an awesome year for him, 5-10 true shooting percentage, well below the league average, especially for a big man, and he shot an unsustainably well 47% on long twos. Doesn't really take that many threes. I don't think that Scott Brooks is necessarily going to be encouraging him finally to expand his range either. And because they have two really good options at center, he's going to be playing power forward, which he's probably not capable of handling defensively anymore from a quickness standpoint. You know, his spacing and his mid-rangers mean a lot more when you're playing him at center, and I think that's how he was effective.
Is it possible? Is it possible that this was a misevaluation, kind of like Timofey Mozgov, where it was like, oh my god, we can get this guy at this price. We can't turn that down. Except that Jason Smith isn't that good, because he doesn't make any sense with their team unless they're going to trade Gortat.
And so they're now capped out too. I think they still have the room exception left, right? Am I right about that, or did they sign someone that I'm forgetting?
I believe they still have that available.
Yeah. So, but they couldn't have just spent that on the best wing available. Just give that contract to, because that's what they really need. I mean, I think they're relying on getting some minutes out of Kelly Oubre now, and even Otto Porter is sort of not really played at like a good starter level so far in his 3-year career either. So I would have wanted to get more firepower on the wing there. They also don't really have the horses to play small if they want to either. So this signing does not really make a ton of sense to me as well, especially when you already have three pretty good big guys in Markieff and Jan Mahimi and Gortat. But other than that, I think Washington has had a nice offseason. I am just not a particular fan of this move. But, I mean, I think you would have to look at the Utah Jazz as having had one of the best offseasons.
Absolutely. They've made their team a lot better in a way that doesn't hamstring them long term. I wrote a piece a long time ago now for the Sporting News about how Utah was in this really complicated spot because every single player that they had on their roster basically last season is going to get a pay raise on their next deal. Because Hayward favors, you know, even guys who are on their extensions, and of course they have an army of guys that are on their rookie contracts, and so all those guys are, and they've done well, so all those guys are going to get paid more. So what they did with this is, so they gave up one first round pick for George Hill, and then they got Joe Johnson on a pretty reasonable contract. Then they were able to acquire Boris Diaw for nothing, and well, Olivier Allant, who's intriguing, but not a whole lot.
Yeah, well, I mean, he was unintriguing enough that they didn't even bother signing him to a contract as a second rounder last year, and certainly was not in their plans given their glut.
And he was on their summer league team, so they got to evaluate. I'm pretty sure I saw him in summer league last year, so it's not like there's a lack of evaluation there. And Diaw is a wonderful fit for what Utah is doing, and I'm a little bit lower on Trey Lyles than most, and I openly admit that, but even if you're high on him, what Boris does is allow you to have a much higher floor in that sense and not just rely on Trey Lyles. And if Lyles is awesome when he plays, then you can either marginalize Boris or you can just make Lyles the guy next year.
Yeah, I think Boris, there's a possibility he could kind of be done. He had a nice regular season as part of a Spurs second unit that killed it. He was coming out that groin injury, did not play that well in the playoffs. I think the Spurs kind of did him a solid by sending him to Utah, a place where he wanted to go, where he has that relationship with Gobert. As you have noted, and obviously Dennis Lindsay knows the San Antonio higher-ups well, and Diaw, I think as long as like they don't feel obligated to play him, I think this will be a pretty good move, and just to get more passing on the floor. He kind of just doesn't shoot threes anymore, which is odd, but they'll want to do that a little more. But the way Quinn Snyder wants to play, moving the ball, passing from the bigs, cutting back door, handoff type of game, I think he can be pretty useful for that. But I think he's either like 34 or 35 now, so he could be about done. We'll see. Another former Sun, this one actually returning to Phoenix, much like Jared Dudley. 2 years, $8 million for Leandro Barbosa in Phoenix. So obviously he's being paid so much more. The most the Warriors could pay him, they had to dump his cap hold when they signed Durant. So the most they could pay him was the minimum. This 2 years, $8 million has a team option for a second year. And sometimes team option and non-guarantee are, you know, people don't really get into the nuances of that. But the advantages of a team option, there are some. Although you generally, a non-guarantee is a little bit better because you can actually trade the guy. But a team option, at least, you can decline it if you want to bring him back for longer or even for less money. You can decline it, and then it's not like you've waived him and just, you know, you can't re-sign him. He's going to another team or could get claimed or something. So there are some advantages of a team option. We'll see what that actually is. But I think for LB, good locker room guy along with Dudley. They obviously have struggled in that respect a little bit. Everyone in Golden State raved about him, and I think they will miss him just from a character standpoint, a kind of keeping everyone happy and motivated. He wrote a nice message on Instagram, and he'll kind of be missed around Golden State, but a good signing, I think, by Phoenix, which, you know, wasn't doing anything else with their cap space, so you might as well, again, bring in a guy who might play a little bit, but mostly is just going to be a good locker room guy and be played relatively well for the privilege.
And there is a direct analog to that with other Warriors teammate Brandon Rush signing a one-year, $3.5 million deal with Minnesota. And while he didn't show as much during this season or last season as Barbosa, though we did have a nice run when Harrison Barnes was out with an ankle injury, I think that it makes sense when, under the theory that Minnesota was in, that they didn't want to spend a ton of their money this year, that he's a steady vet, a good locker room presence, and a guy who can actually shoot, which is good for them to have.
Yeah, I don't know if he's like some great locker room presence. Like when he was in Utah, for example, that year, he was like, after he got traded initially to clear salary from the Warriors, he basically, you know, was just out of shape and didn't really play at all. But it's more, I think, a missed opportunity for Golden State because, as we talked about, signing him up to the early bird exception of $6.2 million simply so you could have some fodder to trade. You know, if they wanted to make a trade with one of their first-rounders or Looney, or maybe if McCaw starts playing well, if they wanted to trade for someone in the last year of their contract, nobody, they don't have anybody who's superfluous in terms of money that they can match up. So, yeah, they couldn't have traded him if they'd signed him under that until January 15th. But if I were them, I would have just beaten that offer and maybe could have played him a little bit because he shoots the ball okay and isn't horrible on defense. I don't think he would have had any more likely chance of playing in Minnesota than he does in Golden State. So I think that money probably would have trumped it. And if you had signed him and signed McAdoo, then you can cobble together enough salary to go get like a Taj Gibson or someone in the last year of their contract, maybe even like Danilo Gallinari or someone like that. So he probably would fetch a higher price than Golden State could pay. But nonetheless, there'll be guys in the last year of their contract. If you wanted to throw a first rounder at them, you could get them with that salary. And now I don't think that is really going to be as much of an option. We'll see what happens with McAdoo, whether they bring him back or not.
And what I understand from Rush's perspective is that it is strange to be signed basically as a trade asset. Like, that is a strange thing to do. But at the same point, if you're getting more money, you get to play on a team that you won a championship with. I can see why he would want the stability of something else for a good situation, but at the same point, I could also see it the other way, and just especially considering he left about $2.5 million on the table if that offer was there. We don't know if it was. We both would have made it, but we're also not Bob Myers.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't heard anything about that offer being out there, so I don't have any reason to believe right now that was made. Charlotte signs Brian Roberts to the veteran minimum. He had played there recently until he was traded to Portland. I like the signing. He's getting up there in age, but still a guy who can stroke it, and maybe you could see a need for him, if Sessions gets hurt or Walker gets hurt, or, and remember, Walker, again, is coming off another meniscus surgery, or if Sessions, who can't really shoot it, they're kind of not playing him honestly, and so you want to put the ball in the hands of Batum with the second unit, let him make plays, and then you've got Roberts off the ball who can shoot it instead. And then finally, wrapping things up here, Jeremy Evans. We talked about Dallas's situation that they basically had like $191,000 too much on their books to fit in all of their contracts and Dirk's cap hold to allow them to give him that $20 million a year. So the way they resolved that, what I had suggested that everyone could take less, they came up with a better solution, which was just throwing some cash in with Jeremy Evans, who is at the minimum, to open up the room, send him to Indiana, where in theory he could get into the mix at backup four where they need somebody. But he's older than you think. He's in his late 20s now, losing some athleticism, wasn't even really a rotation player in his prime. So I don't think he'll make a difference, but Dallas paid them to take him, so I'm sure they were happy to do so. All right, we got anything else we got to talk about here before we go?
No. Okay, can I make a plug?
Yes.
So it isn't out yet, but I have it recorded. There's still some logistical work that's going in on it. I'm editing it. But the Real Jam Radio podcast will come out probably in the next 12 hours after we recorded this. And my guests are Dan Feldman. We talked about the offseason so far. And Sirat Sohi talking about Durant and just where all this goes. And also we start talking about Westbrook a little bit as well.
All right. Two of my favorites. That'll be awesome. I'm going to be driving back from Vegas in a few days. So I will get a chance to listen to that then. You can follow me on Twitter at @NateDuncanNBA, follow Danny at Danny LaRue. Don't forget about our sponsors today, the Ring Video Doorbell. Find out more about them at ring.com/capspace. Make sure you enter that URL so they know that you came from us. And, of course, SeatGeek, the inaugural sponsor of the podcast. You can get a $20 rebate off your first SeatGeek purchase by entering that familiar cap space code in the settings tab when you make that first purchase. Also, anyone who wants to tell your friends about us, we really appreciate that. Numbers have been strong during this free agent period, so that's been awesome. And anything you could do to help expand the Dunkdown community, we really appreciate that. iTunes review or rating, also greatly appreciated. Even the ones who give us completely unwarranted, of course, negative reviews. Actually, we do appreciate the constructive criticism, so that's totally fine too. Thanks so much for listening. I think we probably, it seems like things are really calmed down now. Wade was kind of the last big domino, so I would imagine that we probably won't be back until maybe early next week, unless something big happens. But after 15 hours of podcasts or so over the last week, I think I'm ready for a slight break. So we'll talk to you all next time.